So good afternoon, everybody. So we come to the session, I would say finally, on the strategic dialogue and on US-India relationships. And we have an excellent panel, as has been through the day. Every panel has been absolutely excellent. We have Mr. Ashley Tellis of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Daniel Marquis, Senior Fellow of Council of Foreign Relations, Harsh Pant, King's College, and Mr. Uday Bhaskar, National Maritime Foundation. The biodatas are all with you, and we're not going into any introductions. We'll go straight into the session. The same rules apply as have been applying through every session, except that we are going to reduce the 10 minutes to 7 minutes, because this panel, as opposed to the other panels, has 4 speakers. So if we can limit our comments to 7 minutes, and I know that we go over time, so I'm keeping that leeway in hand. And can I ask Ashley to kick off the discussions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be here with you this afternoon to talk about the state of the U.S.-India relationship. Steve Cohen thought that it would be most useful if my remarks today were directed not at the future prospects of the relationship, but to ask the fundamental question that American policymakers have been asking in recent months, and that is whether the U.S.-India relationship has actually lived up to its potential after the epochal events of the last few years. This question has acquired a certain significance because there is a widespread perception in Washington, and I suspect elsewhere in this country, that the bilateral relationship has been moving sideways. And the aftermath of how the civil nuclear agreement has evolved in terms of liability legislation, the failure of the United States to win the combat aircraft competition, have become at least two of the big poster children for those who believe that the relationship between the United States and India has not yielded the fruits that those of us who worked to construct this relationship had advertised in the years gone by. And there is obviously a certain sense of dismay on the part of those who ask the question of whether the United States actually paid too high a cost to build this relationship, given that the fruits, at least as evidenced by these two examples, have been somewhat meager. Now, in asking this question and using these two examples as answers to derive the reasons for dismay, I think one could get the impression that the U.S.-India relationship was driven primarily by the effort to secure access to India's markets. If that is the yardstick by which the integrity of the relationship is to be judged, then, of course, the relationship has certainly not yielded the fruits that people expected. But I think the presumption of transactionalism, which is embedded in this question, is dangerous to the future of the relationship. And more than dangerous, it certainly did not reflect the intentions of U.S. policymakers when they set about building this relationship. And I think it's important to remind ourselves of what those original intentions were, because to my mind, those represent the only sustainable yardsticks by which we can judge the progress of U.S.-India cooperation. There were three reasons why the United States embarked on building a new relationship with India. The first was the recognition that India was simply going to be a rising power in the international system, and that larger U.S. interests would be served by ending a very unproductive 50 years of estrangement. The second was the clear expectation that the United States and India shared not simply values, but fundamentally interests across a range of issue areas in international politics. And the third reason was the recognition that India would be a very vital component in maintaining a stable Asian balance of power. If India's strength and if India's capability were to materialize. And from that perspective, the U.S. drew the conclusion that American interests would be served if the United States were to help India in material and institutional terms to build up that strength and capability. And everything that was done in the last 10 years, going back to the moments when Strobe Talbot, who is now in this institution, began the first dialogue with India, all the way to what President Obama did when he was last in Delhi, have really been putting the building blocks in place to strengthen India's capacity to grow in power because of the benefits that would provide the United States. In other words, I would make two arguments. First, if you use these three criteria as the yardsticks by which to measure progress in the partnership, I would argue that we have succeeded substantially. The estrangement between the United States and India is now a thing of the past. There is a very clear conviction on both sides that there are enduring interests that bind the two countries. And we have made great progress in actually working towards how we act upon those common interests. The record is not perfect, but I do not expect the record to be perfect within a period of 10 years at a time when both countries are still feeling each other out, and when both countries are still substantially limited by the constraints of their own domestic politics. And by the third criteria, that India has been growing in strength and therefore could play the role that we imagine it would play in the Asian balance of power, I think we've made great progress on that by that yardstick as well. Not necessarily because of things the United States has done, but because of the things that India has done and which it will hopefully continue to do. In other words, I would make the argument that the U.S.-India partnership has actually been far more fruitful than people often think, not because India has been doing things for the United States, but rather because India is well on its way to becoming a resilient and capable power. And if it succeeds in that objective, then that growth in resilience and strength is fundamentally beneficial to the United States and to the vision of global power that the United States seeks to forge as we deal with the challenges ahead of us. And so the real disappointments that seem to be pervasive in this city and elsewhere today, it seemed to me arise because it is based on fundamentally mistaken premises. The original vision of strategic convergence risks being replaced by a transactionalism that is quite futile. It fails to appreciate that great transformations are not things that would occur instantaneously, but will slowly mature and become manifest with time. It forgets that even as India is reaching out to the United States and the United States is reaching out to India, both countries are still constrained by their own histories and the legacies of the past. And while the pressures of necessity will compel them to transcend these legacies, they're not going to happen instantaneously or overnight. And finally, it is based again on a confusion about what India will be like as an alliance partner. And it fails to forget that India will never be a formal alliance partner of the United States. And that's just fine. As long as the India that we help nurture and that the India that grows in power ends up becoming strong, capable, and pursuing objectives that are fundamentally convergent with American interests. So are there risks to strategic partnership? Yes, the answer is there are risks to strategic partnership. But those risks to strategic partnership do not derive from what India does or does not do vis-a-vis the United States. the real risk to strategic partnership derive from whether India makes the right decisions that enhance its own capabilities or not. And fortunately or unfortunately for us, most of those decisions have to be made back in India itself. And so we need to be rooting for India to make the right decisions, first for its own sake, because if it makes the right decisions for its own sake, it would have done far more to advance American interests and the American vision of what constitutes a desirable global order than an effort to buy one reactor or one more airplane from the United States. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. So we go on to Daniel.
Thank you, and thanks for the opportunity to address you all today. The title of this panel is Areas of Strategic Cooperation Between the United States and India, and as a means to address that issue, which is something that I certainly like to see improved, I thought I would point out what I would describe as four fundamental challenges to U.S.-India strategic cooperation. And I think by focusing on these challenges, it may give us a window into how we should prioritize our responses to these challenges, where we should put our energies to improve that cooperation. And the four challenges that I would identify are China, Pakistan, development, and capacity. And I'll speak about each of these in order. So starting with China, and here, I'll be candid, I'm doing a little bit of a riff off of Ashley's recent book chapter in the Strategic Asia volume. I think it's unsurprisingly excellent, but I think it captures the logic of what I see as the fundamental challenge to strategic cooperation between the United States and India when you bring China into the mix. And the issue has to do with the fact that both the United States and India are dependent upon their economic relationship with China more so than they are with each other, and that the weight of that economic tie back to China is, if anything, increasing. And so no matter what the political, diplomatic, moral, or other considerations that may draw India and the United States closer together, they will both have to remain cognizant of the fact that there's something else that China offers that neither of them right now offer each other, at least not at the degree to the degree that they have with China. Trade and economic interests simply with China simply swamp those between India and the United States. And so what you see is this tension in the U.S.-India relationship. And you see it in two different ways. You see it in the question of whether, if push were to come to shove, they could count on each other, or whether the allure of the China market or the hold that China has over their economies, and more so the United States, I think, than India at this stage, will win out. And this is, I think, a fundamental challenge to strategic cooperation between our two countries. Second, as I said, is Pakistan. Now, through most of the history of the past six-plus decades, the problem of Pakistan has divided the United States and India, but in different ways. You've seen the U.S. tilt toward Pakistan. You have seen the United States hyphenate the India-Pakistan relationship, that is, believe that in order to engage with either of the parties, first some spade work had to be done with respect to their regional bilateral difference and be hamstrung by that belief. And so it's only been, I would say, over the past decade that you've seen a relatively more successful strategy that is characterized here in Washington, or has been until recently, of dehyphenation, that is, that you could move forward on the relationship with India while at the same time moving forward in a very different way on a very different kind of relationship with Pakistan. And the consequence of that actually, I think, had been quite positive. That is, you saw the United States capable of having leverage with both India and Pakistan and improving its relationship with both countries more so than you had ever seen before. And this was a fundamental improvement. Now, the threat to that now is, of course, the fact that we appear to be veering toward or maybe already in a rupture with Pakistan. And I would suggest that this falls in the category from an Indian perspective, or should, of be careful what you wish for. The Indian belief that the United States had misplaced misunderstanding its relationship with Pakistan has been voiced to me on many, many, many occasions, with the implication being that the United States should have cut ties with Pakistan. But now that we're seeing something that looks more and more like that, I think we will all suffer. The third issue or challenge to our cooperation is development, or in shorthand, development. And I'm no expert, I'm no economist, but it doesn't take one to recognize that we're just simply at very different stages in our economic development in considerable ways. That this places us, the United States and India, on different sides of some of the central issues of global politics today. That is, trade issues, climate change issues, energy issues, and so on. And so while there may be ways, and I hope there are ways, to square these circles, we need to recognize that we do have competing interests and that they are reasonable and rational given the state of economic development of our two countries and the fact that we're not in the same place on these points. And fourth, the issue of capacity. On the U.S. side, I think that we've always struggled with strategic planning and with the idea of, and then by consequence, the idea of a strategic partnership or cooperation with other states. This has never come especially easily to us. I think it will be increasingly difficult to pull off in an era, as we look ahead, of diminishing resources and how that will play in terms of our capacity to think strategically about India and many other issues as well is worrisome. On the Indian side, they have a very different set of challenges. And here I think the problem comes with India's ability to harness or make use of the increasing resources that may be at hand in its ability to act globally, act internationally. So and the question here is whether, as the United States feels a pinch, and as in terms of its resources, and as India is able to make considered investments in its interaction globally, whether they will do so in ways that prioritize their relationship. And I don't think that's necessarily a given. Let me make some very modest recommendations on each of these points. I don't presume that I can answer or solve these challenges, but just to point perhaps some constructive ways ahead. On the China issue, clearly transparency to remove or allay some of the fears, the mutual concerns, about what, in the case of the United States, what India may be doing to cooperate with China, what the United States may be doing to cooperate with China from an Indian perspective, are absolutely necessary. The idea that the United States was moving toward a G2 condominium, or that India was signaling something dramatic about its relationship with the United States through BRICS summitry, is the sort of thing that you can begin to clear the air the more transparent the relationship is. The second, and this is an even more preliminary observation, would be that because we're both bound to China through economic ties, this has suggested that we are in some ways paralyzed by our mutual dependence upon China in a sense. But of course, it's a two-way street. And the more that India and the United States can think about their economic leverage with China as something that they can combine and think about as an area of cooperation in their dealings with China, I think the more potential there will be there. On Pakistan, I think we have two potential scenarios looming. If the U.S.-Pakistan relationship really goes off the rails, the area for India-U.S. cooperation is one in terms of defense, of military cooperation, of intelligence cooperation, of insulating ourselves from the consequences of that failed relationship, and increasingly of a Pakistan that is veering if not toward failure, but toward instability, perhaps failure. Far better, of course, given my gloomy prognosis, would be that somehow we could pull out of this and that we could find a situation which mirrors more, at least in a strategic sense, the period that we had seen several years ago of closer to dehyphenation, where we can move ahead with India and ahead with Pakistan on different terms. With respect to development, I think, again, this may be a transparency issue, but it's striking to me that in a process sense that the U.S. and India appear not to have made it a habit to collaborate ahead of every major multilateral forum and appear not to have a habit of coordinating their activities at the UN on a variety of issues in ways that you would have anticipated by this stage might have become more natural. And although this example is outside the area of development, I think it applies. I'm told that prior to India's vote on the Libya issue, that the United States made a meager effort to reach out to the Indian delegation in New York, that it anticipated that India probably wouldn't sign up to our position and therefore didn't work all that hard to change any minds. If this is true, and I'm assuming it is, this is an example of where we could do more for our part, and certainly it's a reciprocal expectation. And then finally on capacity, of course, these kinds of dialogues, formal dialogues, strategic dialogues are all very helpful, and I applaud them. But in order to increase India's long-term capacity for thinking strategically about the world, and I've written about this elsewhere, the emphasis really needs to be on building both capacity within its government and without. And I would put my finger on the potential for education to be a driver here, and particularly in higher education, and the efforts that many U.S. universities are making to establish themselves in India. I'm told, I had heard that there were significant barriers to this, and I am more recently told that these barriers are largely illusory, and that in fact there are opportunities for U.S. universities to essentially bypass some of the blockages, the procedural blockages in India, and go straight to the states and work with Indian partners to set up campuses. And I would recommend that this is an area where we could really do more as well to promote long-term strategic cooperation in ways that will have multiple payoffs in many different areas. And I'll leave it there.
Thank you very much. We can go on to Harsh.
Thank you. I would, Ashley and Dan both have laid out very clearly the conceptual challenges that India and that U.S.-India partnership faces, and what are the risks and what are the opportunities out there. I would be more empirical in the sense that I would take us all back to the to the strategic dialogue that happened when Secretary Clinton visited India in July, and what some of the issues that emerged out of the dialogue. Before I do that, it's been a long day and very productive one for a lot of us. But I've been struck by one fact, that in three sessions that we have had, our American friends have told us three things, that India and America are not engaging substantively on China, that they are not engaging substantively on Afghanistan and Pakistan, and finally, that they are not. In the last session, we were told that there is no significant move at substantive engagement on issues of global governance. Now, this is a striking indictment of a strategic relationship, in my humble view. Because if these three issues are not being debated, then what the hell are we talking about? And I think, I go back to the dialogue that happened when Secretary Clinton visited India. And she visited India because there was a genuine concern that the relations were drifting and that the relations need to be put back on track. And also, what she wanted to do was allay some of these concerns that core Indian interests are not being taken into account in Washington, and therefore to allay some of those concerns about Washington's intentions vis-a-vis Indian security concerns. And this is true that both sides have been struggling for some time to give substance to a strategic relationship, to a relationship that seems to be losing traction in the last few years. As Ashley discussed, it was the civilian nuclear deal that in a way transcended this relationship to another level. And this idea that India's nuclear program, hitherto treated as illegal, was finally out in the open. It was bolstering India's legal status. It defined the redefined the relationship altogether in structural terms and bilateral terms. But what has happened in the last few years is some of the functional and regional issues have emerged that have again become very significant in the bilateral ties, whether it's terrorism, and the AFPAC region, the nuclear cooperation, and India's role in the Asia-Pacific. On all of these issues, there were significant differences when if you look how the strategic dialogue, the U.S.-India strategic dialogue shaped up. First, on terrorism, the Secretary promised to lean hard on Pakistan. She underlined that the U.S. does not believe that there are any terrorists or should be given safe haven, and again, referring to Indian concerns that the perpetrators of the Mumbai attacks are still in Pakistan. The terrorists are still being trained and bettered and aided in Pakistan. And while ties between Washington and Islamabad have worsened dramatically since bin Laden was found and killed in May, New Delhi still remains worried about the fact that that Washington needs to do more. Of course, things have changed in the last few days. We have the episode of the recent events and the recent outburst in Washington. But still, I think it remains a case that from India's perspective, it is seen as very tactical in nature. That, yes, something needs to be done about the terror issue. But from India's perspective, this is something that India had been laboring on for the last so many years. And yet, the issues have not been given due consideration. The second on the question of India's role in its neighborhood, I think it's Washington's turn to be unhappy. And so you had in Chennai, Secretary Clinton asking India to exercise political influence in consonance with its growing economic weight. Exhorting India to lead, she asked New Delhi to do more to integrate economically with neighbors like Afghanistan and Pakistan and to play a bigger role in the Asia-Pacific. And as the situation in Afghanistan has unraveled and as China's rise has upended the balance of power in East Asia, the U.S. has expected India to help emerge as a regional security provider in its own right. But India remains a reluctant power, even in its own vicinity, and has shown little appetite to lead on regional security issues, at least at the moment. Its grand strategy remains incomprehensible even to its friends. Its military policy remains mired in bureaucracies. The current government remains paralyzed by a whole host of governance issues. So in that sense, you can understand some of the frustration that has been boiling up in Washington about India's inability to lead on regional security issues or to emerge as a regional security provider. Of course, many in Delhi would argue that Washington itself stymies India's emergence in its neighborhood. The Obama administration has been given contradictory signals since it came to power on AFPAC, for example. Mrs. Clinton asked India to step up, but President Obama's plans to end America's combat role in Afghanistan by 2014 leave India with limited choices. Pakistan's army wants a pliable government in Kabul, as we were discussing early on, and at a time when Washington is deciding to move out, India is there to fend for its own security, Washington seems to be suggesting, and therefore the consequences are all there for India to bear, and how India deals with those challenges again becomes a point of friction between the two sides as the date comes nearer. As far as China is concerned, there has been some ambivalence in Washington in signaling India what America wants in its relations with China. Washington has gone from talking of a G2 to thinking of a more muscular response. This ambivalence has been reflected in India's own response to China, and though in recent years it has become more muscular. Third, and very interestingly, and I think it is perhaps the one idea that had transformed the bilateral relationship, the nuclear deal itself has been facing setbacks. On the Indian side, the issue has been India's civil nuclear liability bill, not very popular even, I think, in the Indian private sector, but of course not in Washington. On the other side has been America's support for the NSG's new guidelines for tightening the exports of enrichment and reprocessing technologies. Now, again, it remains unclear what Washington has been supporting and what it has not been supporting as far as the new ENR guidelines are concerned. But as far as India goes, the argument has been made in India that it could not have been done without some sort of a support from Washington. And this goes back to a concern that India has had long back with Obama administration's own ideological posturing about nuclear global non-proliferation regime. And many in India contend that if this were to proceed, India's nuclear program itself would be threatened because India would be forced into signing the NPT and CTBT, et cetera, the same old debates that one thought were out of the picture for a while. Finally, I think one needs to be very clear when one talks of terms like a strategic relationship as to what we mean, what the two sides mean by a strategic dialogue. What are the objectives here that India has set for itself, and what are the objectives that Washington has set for itself in trying to achieve something of their bilateral relationship? And we tend to hear statements like U.S. and India are natural allies. I don't think U.S. and India are natural allies. I think if they were natural allies, an alliance would have happened long back. But there are, it's a relationship that can be made more productive. And the strategic vision that U.S. and India have still remains poles apart. And therefore, you need dialogues at multiple levels to bridge that gap. And again, I come back to the discussion that I started from, that it is interesting to hear the lament that U.S. and India are not having a productive dialogue on any of the substantive issues that animate this relationship today. So I think this partnership can only achieve its full potential if the hard security issues that both sides care about are put on the table and both sides are honest about their expectations of the other side. India, of course, has to do a lot. It has to stop punching below its weight in Asia and start acting as a rising power, as many in Washington would like it to, while Washington also has to understand some of the core security concerns that India has. So while I conclude by saying that while I do agree with the larger conceptual roadmap that Ashley so eloquently laid out, I think there remain enormous obstacles. And given our discussion earlier in the day, it doesn't. I'm not convinced that two countries are on the right track in terms of harmonizing this relationship. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We move on to Mr. Uday Bhaskar.
Thank you, Chair. At the outset, I think I'm conscious of the fact that I'm the last speaker after a very rich day, and looking at this room, you know, one can talk about the depth of the deliberations being matched by the depth of this very special room in Brookings. I'm delighted to be back. You know, it's been a long time since I've come back to Brookings. And as I said, I'm also conscious that perhaps I'm the only sailor definitely on the panel. Ashley's only an honorary sailor, and I don't know about the rest of the audience. So I've been advised by... Okay, sorry. We are two sailors. I was advised by our Secretary General, Dr. Rajiv Kumar, that as the sailor, perhaps I should, you know, try and focus on the maritime domain, and which I shall do, and maybe remind this audience, I'm sure some of you are already aware, that when we review the India-U.S. relationship, there are many facets. We have Dennis Cook's now, I think, familiar book about estranged democracies and where we have moved from there. But there's a little niche, you know, which I think sailors would perhaps revel in, which is that if you look at the bilateral, and I stumbled on this when I was doing some work in the early 90s, trying to find the punctuations in the India-U.S. relationship. The Cold War had just got over, and I was talking to a few people here in Washington about their recall of the India-U.S. relationship, considering that there was no official contact for many years, and I was working in an institute which represented the only contact, if you will, between New Delhi and Washington. And two things came up, which was quite, as I said, I was not aware of it, that everyone knows that India figured in the American calculus in a negative way in May 1974 with the first nuclear test, the peaceful nuclear explosion. But on a more positive note, I gathered this anecdotally, that India came up for the equivalent of a favorable comment in late 1988. President Reagan was at the helm, and this was reference to the way in which India dealt with a very sort of, shall we say, a mercenary coup that was attempted in the Maldives. Operation Cactus. And what was extraordinary, so I gathered from Washington, was that if you look at the map, and this apparently is what was brought to the attention of the U.S. president, that there was this coup that was being attempted in the Maldives, and India, Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi then at the helm, ably supported by Mr. Ronan Sen, who was the Joint Secretary, they dealt with this and dealt with the coup very adroitly. We had two ships in the vicinity. They were diverted, the INS Biyas and the Godavari. And in about 24 hours, we were able to airlift the paracommandos from Agra. And all this happened in 1988, 1 year before Tiananmen. And India, Third World, Cold War, etc., etc. So this was one indicator of India, shall we say, strategic, nascent, but strategic profile, which was registered here in Washington in 1988. Fast forward, December 2004, Bush 1, President Bush in the White House, And India's response again to tsunami, which, as you recall, those of you who were on watch in that particular year, it happened on a weekend, Christmas weekend. And Indian ships were able to cast off and arrive outside the most affected areas between 12 to 24 hours. So these were, shall we say, two instances of India's strategic capability that had registered here. And I thought I would perhaps take this forward and look at the India-US relationship in a strategic context and highlight maybe areas that could be identified for possible cooperation. Now, at the very outset, if you look at the relationship, I mean, we've had two views. I think Ashley has given us a very, very, I would say, inspiring kind of view about what impelled July 2005. And Harsh, in turn, has pointed out that it's going to be very difficult to dot the I's and cross the T's. My own take on this is that actually India and the United States, having spent some time trying to understand the complexities of the relationship, more than defining it as a partnership or as an alliance, I have often veered towards looking at them as two very complex ecosystems, and that they can complement each other if we have the right degree of managing a complex relationship, and that the governments actually are only one component, that there are various facets to the India-US relationship. There is this large civil society component, which I think Swami made this point in his remarks, that even at a time when the two governments were estranged, you had the first professionals coming from different parts of India in the mid-70s. And as I said, I don't want to go into that detail. There are diaspora experts here. But there is this ecosystem, and that is what I would point to say that there is a strategic texture to the India-US relationship. And my own advocacy over the years has been that it should not be viewed in transactional terms, that the relevance of India and the United States to each other is existential. And they complement each other in a very complex but dynamic manner. And we've seen some elements of this being recognized now. If you look at the articulation on both sides, I will not detain you with what Mr. Vajpayee had once said, but that's Hindi. So those who have a Hindi sort of facility, we can talk about that later. But I want to make this point that if you review the relationship, there were two points, I think, at which you saw the way in which it was being transmuted. Not transformed, it was being transmuted. And my own reading is that the first was March 2005, when Ms. Condi Rice visited India before she went to Tokyo. And when I did my homework, I always thought that was a very seminal articulation about the vision that was driving the United States in 2005. And from March, we quickly come up to July 2005. And finally, the fall of 2008, when the nuclear nettle, again, is very innovatively, I would say, that circle had been squared between on the Bush-Manmohan Singh agreement, notwithstanding the problems that we are facing now. In similar vein, I'd like to suggest that in as much as May 1974, peaceful nuclear explosion, takes 31 years, July 2005, the fine print of the civilian nuclear agreement, finally realized by a squeak, you come down to the wire, and I can see some of the players who did some heavy lifting over here, the nuclear nettle has been put aside after 34 years, May 74 to September 2008. In similar vein, I'd like to suggest that May 2011, Osama bin Laden and the Abbottabad operation mark the beginning of the second transmutation that is currently on the anvil, which is the United States and India being able to review the way in which they have looked at the scourge of terrorism. And I recall distinctly as a Track 2 representative coming here in 1993, and Bruce Rydell was then part of the White House security staff, and the way in which the United States, I think, shared with us their own understanding about the scourge of terrorism and where we have moved, I would say, over the last 13 years. So it's in that sense that I'd like to locate the India-US bilateral relationship and draw attention to the context in which this is going to play out. Again, in the morning session, I think Swami made this point, that the world is moving towards the equivalent of a tripolar single economy. Now, one reading says that China has already overtaken the United States to be the world's number one economy. I am more conservative. I am going for 2022, which is the figure that's been identified, the bandwidth between 2022 to 25, when China overtakes the United States to be the number one economy in the world in actual terms. The United States is number two, and India would be a distant third. Yes, you would have other economies. Today's Japan, today's Germany. We're not quite sure how the EU is going to cohere. We're not quite sure about Brazil. But all things being equal, and this morning there was reference to China's Arab Spring, but all things being equal, India, United States, and China operating on the current trajectories that they are on, it's very likely that you'll have this tripolar economy, United States, China being close to each other, China being number one, India a distant third. And this is where I'd like to suggest that this particular world order, 2025, 2022, as opposed to the multipolar formulation, which has been used by various commentators and analysts, my own preference is to talk about a polycentric order, meaning that to the extent that multipolarity suggests a kind of power grid, I am suggesting a diffused spatial arrangement in which you will have China, United States, and India as three nodes of relevance, complemented by Russia, by Japan, by Germany, by a Brazil, maybe an ASEAN, depending on how they get their act together. And the real challenge, as I see it, which is of relevance to India and the United States, is the management of this triangle, US-China-India relationship. And again, without going into detail, my most desirable end state in terms of managing this relationship is that we are all familiar with the contradictions. The fact that there are certain tensions in how they relate to each other, but also the way in which they complement each other, particularly as impelled by globalization. So to that extent, my proposition is that India is in a very favorable position, which is that despite the fact that it is subaltern, both to the United States and in China, in every aspect of tangible national power, there is a ceiling in terms of how the United States and China relate to each other. And to that extent, India can be a very empathetic swing state. And this, I think, is the characteristic that India and the United States need to recognize and see what is the objective they are striving for. I'm an analyst. I'm not in government. So I have the liberty of outlining a vision, which is about a condition of equitable equipoise. That seems like alliteration. But what I mean by that is the senator, when he was speaking this morning from Virginia, he was drawing attention to those pockets which have not benefited from globalization. And this is a problem the world over. It's not confined only to the United States. So the end state, you know, when we have people from the business, we have people from government, we have academics, we have analysts, we have people in gender studies, how do large states like India, China, and the United States arrive at this holy grail of equitable equipoise? And in that, I believe that India would have a role to play. And much of it would be, how do you manage China? This morning we spoke about the rise of China. What does it mean? And this is not rocket science, to say that both India and the United States would have to engage with China while at the same time being able to manage its rise in a way whereby China is encouraged to conform, to comply with rules, norms as we evolve them. And to that extent, my second proposition is that the nature of the triangle, India, China, and the United States, would be predicated to a very large extent on the manner in which they understand and relate to the extended commons. We started this whole discussion about the maritime domain and saying that India and the United States have a shared interest in the maritime domain. I'm extending this to say that you have maritime, cyber, and space. And the challenge for India and the United States would be the management of this extended commons in such a way that China also becomes a stakeholder and is encouraged to comply, to conform, in a way that its own sensitivities, interests, aspirations, and ambitions, anxieties are all accommodated. Let me quickly finish. I just have a minute to say that, without going to the other points, that for India and the United States, I think I spoke about an ecosystem. I spoke about the fact that this is a triangle that would have to be managed in a very, very innovative and empathetic manner, and that at the end of the day, for India and the United States, I want to borrow that last point from Harsh. It appears that there are many obstacles. And one suggestion I've often made is that there is a need to reconcile the narratives. India has a narrative on the nuclear issue. The United States has its own narrative on the nuclear issue. We have our narrative on terrorism. The United States has its narrative on terrorism. That there is a need for reconciliation, for harmonizing these narratives. And there are specific recommendations as far as this extended commons and these issues are concerned. My proposals are as follows. One is for much greater engagement on track two on these issues, because these are people in the real world, FICCI, those in the private sector, and those in the government. And from track two, to pick up individual issues which lend themselves to some degree of cooperation and have perhaps the equivalent of a track 1.5, where you have people from both within the government and from outside, and then try and identify which are the doables. Thank you.
Thank you very much. As has been through the day, also a very enriching learning experience, at least for me. I mean, as opposed to big boats, I have only sailed small boats. So, but I know that as a sailor, when you have to reach from one point to another, then it's always not a straight distance to go. You have to tack your way through and actually go left and right before you reach the goal. So it is a question of adaptability and understanding situations and taking them as they are, watching the winds blow in your direction, and then catching them to move towards your goal. I mean, let's not get into any other philosophical issues about that. Before I open up the floor to questions, I have one, you know, one issue which I find has been completely missing through the day in terms of maybe that it's an issue which is only to do more with internally with our country. But I feel that, you know, we keep discussing on the business and on the strategic and defense and military framework, but there is no discussion whatsoever on the issue of food security and agriculture, which I feel is going to become a major issue and where I think there is a great need for also some kind of strategy between the US and India to ensure that you know, we are able to feed our people in India. I fear that we will be faced with a huge problem because since the 1970s when we had the Green Revolution with Norman Borlaug leading it, we've really not had any other kind of agricultural revolution of any serious nature. And, you know, that's something which at least I feel is important in this relationship. So can we open up the questions? Please identify yourself and wait for the mic and make your question short. Thank you. Oh, I'm so sorry. Ambassador Sybil wanted to make some comments first, so if you would please allow me that I will. He had already told me in advance.
Well, I'll cut short my intervention because I think we're running out of time.
We have, sir, 5 minutes. You can.
Okay. One, that I'm not persuaded that India's economic relationship with China has become so strong that it imposes limits on our policy choices. You know, the total India-China trade is today $60 billion, but our total economic, and it's the largest trade partner in goods, but our largest economic relationship remains with the United States of America. And the deficit that the United States has with China is probably 3 to 4 times larger than the total Indian-China trade. It may well be that in the years ahead, this might become an important factor, but I don't think that at this stage we should exaggerate the import of this. Secondly, on dehyphenation, you know, it's a play with words. The United States has interests in India. United States has interests in Pakistan. India and Pakistan have a very difficult relationship. The United States has to manage both relationships. So even if you don't use the word hyphenation or dehyphenation, there is de facto a compulsion on the United States to try and balance this relationship in order to derive the maximum leverage from both relationships. If you remember, when Condoleezza Rice came to Delhi and announced the willingness to enter into a comprehensive nuclear deal, she went to Pakistan and declared that Pakistan would be a non-NATO ally of the United States of America. In terms of arms sales to Pakistan, United States has not given up that policy. Robert Gates, when he was in India a few months ago, said that, no, we are calibrating very carefully our arms sales to Pakistan, and they will not create an imbalance, in conventional imbalance in South Asia. And I, from the WikiLeaks, one gathers that the U.S. ambassador to Pakistan recommended continuing arms sales to Pakistan in order to allay Pakistan's security threats from India. On the nuclear deal, while yes, there was a clear de-hyphenation in inverted commas there, but one finds that the United States is giving China a degree of freedom to increase its nuclear relationship with Pakistan, and this was one could see that in the NSC discussions, etc., etc. On Afghanistan, again, there was a tendency initially to link Kashmir to Afghanistan. On terror, I remember that although President Bush was very strongly supportive of, I won't say supportive, recognized India's that India was a victim of terror, but he very steadfastly refused to give us any signal that he was willing to put pressure on Pakistan. He would always defend Pakistan and say that Pakistan actually was a very reliable ally in the war against terror. And on strategic partnership, India got a strategic partnership, but Pakistan too has a strategic partnership. So, you know, but leave that aside. Very, very briefly, I, before I say something on the strategic partnership or areas of strategic cooperation, I want to respond to the Syrian thing, because that's also related to the whole idea of a strategic partnership or areas of strategic cooperation, because I think if the United States were to support India's permanent membership more seriously and more proactively, it will lead to an internal balance within the Security Council. And by giving India a greater role, even if there are some differences on certain issues, the underlying compatibility of long-term interests between India and the United States is such that multilateral action within the United Nations Security Council, as a result of cooperation between India and the United States, would be helpful. Now, in the case of Libya, I think one has to see whether United States' position or those of NATO or Western countries is based on pure principle, or it is based on national interest, or there are domestic pressures at work, or is it a combination of all three factors? So if we agree that it's a combination of all three factors, then India's position on what happens in Libya cannot be based on pure principle. It has also to take into account a national interest, and, of course, domestic political pressures at work. So, therefore, I don't think we should read too much meaning into what's happening in Libya with regard to India's position. Now, insofar as areas of strategic cooperation are concerned, I think the non-aligned phase, insofar as India is concerned, is over, because India pursued that course of action to protect its strategic interests in a divided world. Now the world is interdependent, globalized, and we have to protect our interests in this sort of a world. And here, of course, we are trying to maintain our strategic autonomy. But there's a lot of convergence of interests in many areas. First of all, the global liberal order. We have been victims of it, but nevertheless, I think all right-thinking Indians would agree that the United States is the biggest pillar of a liberal global order, and this pillar must not be weakened. And if tomorrow the Chinese begin to increase their influence in shaping the world order, what values will they bring to this order? Their values, their soft power, what will they bring? I think the world would lose as a result. And therefore, it's in India's and United States' interest to strengthen this global order. The problem is that while we both share our commitment to democracy, and we will not be happy if Chinese authoritarianism becomes some sort of an attractive model for many parts of the world, we have some genuine doubts about going in for democracy as a crusade, and that's where our differences come in. We have some difficulties about going in for a crusade for human rights and for the right to intervention. Now, insofar as the rise of China is concerned, we have a common interest to hedge against this rise without seeking to contain China. But we have no clarity yet as to what the U.S. has in mind in terms of the Chinese threat U.S. wants us to focus on the Chinese threat in the Asia-Pacific region, but we are far more concerned about China's threat in South Asia. And there is here a mismatch. We do not know what the United States thinks about the U.S. Pakistan, the China-Pakistan nexus, about the Chinese penetration into the Indian Ocean area. So unless we have a frank dialogue and understand what the United States thinking along on these issues is, we cannot have that kind of confidence in each other. There are water issues because most of the biggest rivers of Asia are emanating from Tibet. There's the whole issue of Tibet and the Dalai Lama. So we need to discuss these issues also. We need also to be clear about U.S. position on the Pak-China nexus. There's no clarity about U.S. policy as we saw in the NSG, or for that matter in the FMCT, where China is blocking negotiations on the FMCT, and the United States hasn't found a policy to try and remove the roadblock that Pakistan has placed. In the case of terrorism and religious radicalism, both are threats to the United States and India, but we get the feeling at times the U.S. wants to accommodate these forces to some extent. And, of course, this you have now excluded the whole vocabulary of war on terror, which itself is an indication of how you want to be able to fit what's happening in Afghanistan into a larger policy towards the Islamic world. We only hope that this does not leave certain, does not have certain repercussions in our own region with which we have to live with. On Afghanistan, we have common interest in connectivity, in energy cooperation, in access to natural resources. We think U.S. is a stabilizing factor in Central Asia, but we are not sure whether the United States has the willpower and the commitment to, for a long term, stay in this area. On Iran, you should give us more space. On energy, we are doing rather well. In defense, it's another very important area. United States has already got $8 billion worth of arms sales. I think in the $30 billion that we are hoping to buy from suppliers abroad, United States is targeting at least another $8 billion. On technology transfers, we have common interest. We have common interest in protecting the sea lanes of communication. And finally, I would suggest that United States should support India's territorial integrity. That's very important.
Atul Singh from Fair Observer, new journal analyzing global issues. So I have more of a comment, less of a question. And my comment is, both the USA and India are seeing an extraordinary tumult in the US, and I've driven across this country twice. As you drive away from the coasts, you see rust belts, you see towns like Detroit that have deindustrialized. And what someone said earlier, very emphatically and very correctly, is that you're seeing a clash between those who benefited from globalization, the Googles, and those who have lost. And that war is real, and that has made politics vicious. India, again, has its socialist excrescences, its huge bureaucracy and red tape. We were given statistics by Swami. And we have a tiny foreign service, 700, sir, if I'm not mistaken, manning a rising power inadequately, straining at the seams. So the fundamental question here is, before we talk about a relationship, a strategic relationship or a partnership, both these countries, which have ferment in their soul, have to figure out what is their goal. And it's not rhyming, as you were not just making alliteration. It's first, what is it that you're headed towards? And then the relationship, the partnership, the strategy will evolve. And therein, I agree largely with Ashley, and I agree largely with Harsh. Both of them are close friends, that the fundamental issues in these countries are internal. When they solve their soul, when they do what we call in India in the myths, the tapasya, and forge through exercise or purity or concentration, what is it they want, things will evolve because there are natural synergies which will be there for the long run. Those factors will remain.
Thank you. Please, yes, Swami? Sorry, the lady. We'll take the next one from the lady.
Okay. Everybody says that the Arab Spring is a good thing. I'm not entirely sure. There are some discouraging signs that it might turn Islamist. Supposing that happens even halfway, if not completely, what would be the reaction of the United States? What would be the reaction of India? I mean, apart from saying that, you know, it's an unfortunate event. I mean, apart from saying it's unfortunate in concrete terms, what would the United States be inclined to do, and what would India be inclined to do if you saw signs of the Arab Spring turning Islamist?
The next question from the lady. There's a lady up here in the sixth or seventh row.
Hi, I'm Bethany Daniluk from Booz Allen Hamilton. My question is to the panel, anybody who can address this. It's been suggested several times that U.S. entities could engage directly with individual states in India to perhaps bypass some of the bureaucratic and procedural hurdles to achieve their objectives. Is this approach something that the government of India at the national level would be comfortable with, or would if they wouldn't be comfortable, would this then undermine our relations at the national level and our attempts to build a good faith?
Raghuveer Goyal. My question is what Ambassador Sibal said, that what I'm asking is, where do you put today the India-U.S. relations? Where are we heading for tomorrow? Thank you.
Rajesh Kadian. Well, Ashley and I are the two Indian-Americans here. Where do you see a tangible role for Indian Americans, Ashley, in furthering our relationship between the two countries? And a very weird comment on Syria. It's mystifying, as Martin brought it up. But the Alawites are in power. Alawites are a Shia group who also worship the cow.
There's one question right at the back. That's the last one we take from the back.
My question is for Dan and Ashley. My issue is more about, we keep talking about U.S. and India, but nobody's really talked about Congress. And is Congress, the U.S. Congress, in
sync? I'm sorry, we can't hear you up here. Can you just stand up, please, and...
This question, my name is Kap Sharma. This question is for Ashley and Dan. A lot of the discussion today is about what the U.S. and what India should be doing. But we know that the U.S. Congress plays a big role in foreign policy. So I was wondering from Dan and Ashley, what is Congress in general thinking about India? Because while we're talking about having stronger relationships, Congress tends to see India more as a competitor, more as someone who is taking jobs, someone who's going to compete for energy, commodities. And I'm not sure whether Congress is in sync with a lot of the discussion we've had today. So I would like to learn more about that. And also, we're going to have a huge turnover in Congress next year. So Ashley, since you worked in the Bush administration, what do you think the Tea Party and the new Republicans, how do they look at India? Because they're going to be playing an important role in finance, export controls, visas, a lot of different things. So I was quite surprised that Congress, the U.S. Congress, was left largely out of this debate. So if you could comment on that, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. So I will now, we have 5 minutes precisely. We'll allow each panelist to respond to the questions. I mean, there are short questions and there are very long questions like the last one. But we will give 1 minute to each panelist. You can pick up whatever question you want. And
I think... I would just respond to Swami's question on Arab Spring. I don't think we know how India would respond. I don't think Indian policymakers know how they would respond. I don't think in India's approach so far has been very, very cautious in as we have been discussing as to what to do in Libya and Syria, etc. So if it turns if the situation gets more Islamist in orientation, then I'm not so sure they would be very nimble in their response. I think they would take their own time, and once they figure out what to say, they will probably have something to say. But it would take a long time before.
Ashley.
I'll address three questions, and I'll try to do it in 1 minute. On Bethany's question of whether India should engage the states going over the head of the center, I think it's really a question of which issue area you're talking of engagement in. If it's engagement in national security, you have to go through the center. There's no alternative. If it's engagement in the realm of economics, there are plenty of opportunities to go directly to the states, and American corporations have already begun to do that. On the second question of the role of Indian Americans, which Rajesh has written, I think the role of Indian Americans has to be what the role of any citizen in this country is. which is to contribute to the better understanding, at least in terms of bilateral relationship, the better understanding of what is happening in India here, and that is both through our engagement with the executive branch and particularly to Congress. I mean, I'll connect that to the question that Kapil raised, which is citizens have a very special relationship with their representatives. And if Indian Americans, like others, can use that relationship with their representatives to help the Congress understand what the larger issues with the home country have been, then I think it makes a good deal of a difference.
I'll just pick up again 2 points, one by Swami regarding the Arab Spring and which way it goes. I'll just give you my view as a security analyst, which is that, again, I said this in the morning, the United States and India, if you look at the U.S. QDR, the last two QDRs, 2006 and 10, you'll find that terrorism non-state has a very prominent place in terms of challenges to the United States. We in India have gone through 93 Mumbai, November 2008 Mumbai, and whatever we have seen this year. So my limited response as an analyst is that more than the Arab Spring and its Islamist identity, which is cause for concern, it is the supranational agenda that they pursue and the means by which they decide to realize those objectives. And if you have this wave of regimes that decide to use modern technology in the furtherance of the supranational agenda, both India and the United States, I think, would have to really consult very deeply about how to deal with this because of the nature of diversity. And I come back to that ecosystem formulation that for India and the United States, the management of diversity, while being sensitive to whatever the Constitution has enjoined in terms of values, is going to be a challenge. Whether we talk about banning burqas or defining how religion is to be practiced, I think that clash, as I see it, about the supranational agenda of these groups in the event that they do wish to, and how the states, you know, are going to work, will be a point of some concern. It has to be monitored very carefully, and I agree with you. And more than us, I'd imagine the Chinese also would be very, very concerned because of their own proximity to some of these issues.
Okay, I'll just pick up a couple things as well. Some great questions here. I would begin by suggesting that you're absolutely correct that Indian economy is currently far less penetrated by Chinese interest relative to the United States, no doubt. But this is a dynamic, and we have to look out into the future. And I would say that there is good evidence to suggest that that will change over time, and that India will, like the United States is, be increasingly sensitive about how its actions internationally are likely to affect the ramifications of those actions for its relationship, its economic relationship with China. So I would say look to the future there. To clarify on dehyphenation, you know, my use of that word was in a relatively narrow sense. It was only insofar as to suggest that the United States, unlike in the deeper past, should not be paralyzed by the need to resolve the Indo-Pak bilateral conflict before moving ahead and engaging each of those partners for different reasons. It is not in the broader sense of suggesting that U.S. policymakers are not routinely in the business of trying to figure out how everything they do is likely to affect their relationship with the other side. They have to, I mean, realistically, they live in that world, and they're forced to respond and calibrate their activities accordingly. It's simply to escape that paralysis that had bound us in the past. I would have a difference of interpretation on the U.S. just as a point, U.S. response to the Chinese-Pakistani nuclear arrangement. My sense is that the United States was less willing to acquiesce because it thought that it was somehow balancing the civil nuclear deal and simply bowing to what it perceived to be an unpleasant international reality. On Libya, my point was not that the United States could have convinced India to see its side on Libya. The point was simply that as a process issue, we should be in the habit of seeing that consultation in that instance and in many others as being something we simply do. Of course we would do it, and we would do it at length, and we would devote considerable priority to it. And last, just on this issue of going past the MEA, past New Delhi and going directly out to states, my point was a narrow one. Again, they're really related to the establishment of U.S.-branded universities in India, where there have been holdups at the center and where there seems to be a far more greater welcome by state authorities or the potential for that. And this is an opportunity that I think we should not allow the center to sort of hold up progress that could be made in important ways.
Thank you very much. We are coming to the end of this session. And for me, the learning has been that whatever relationships we need to develop, we need to have, and I quite agree with Daniel, if you have to develop a strategic relationship, we need to have transparency in our dialogue, and we need to talk about it. We must put goals as to exactly where we wish to reach, and that's really important. And I know in a jocular manner, I just want to say that a few years back, The Economist described India as a country full of subplots with no plot at all. And I find that it's not much different here. And we need to put this whole plot together before we can come to any kind of conclusion. And as always, any such session leaves us more with questions than with answers. Thank you very much, and thank you so much for the panel.